Welcome back to BSA by Design, a podcast about transforming healthcare educational and research facilities through expert design and insight. I'm your host, Brian Moore, and in this episode, we're joined by several guests to break down Design Assist, a construction process that involves the construction team in the design phase of the project. Let me introduce you to our roundtable of guests. Kevin Hutton joined Indiana University Health in February of 2022 as Director of Engineering of Design and Construction. Before coming to IU Health, Kevin spent over 20 years as a design engineer, primarily focused on healthcare system design as a consultant with BSA. At IU Health, Kevin's primary focus is to ensure the healthcare facility systems are designed to operate reliably while minimizing energy consumption. His role includes developing engineering and sustainability standards, providing guidance and quality control of building designs, and ensuring that systems operate as designed. His work influences design and construction's portfolio of nearly $5 billion in capital projects, including acute care facilities, ambulatory care facilities, and freestanding medical office building. Kevin currently serves as a voting member of the ASHRAE 189.3 Committee for Design, Construction, and Operation of Sustainable High-Performance Healthcare Facilities. He has also spoken at the Midwest Healthcare Conference in Indianapolis in 2023, and the Conference for Integrated Design, Construction, and Operations in Indianapolis in 2024. Andrew Gorman is the Director of Operations Facility Support for Riley Children's Hospital, a graduate of Rose-Hulman Institute of Technology with a Bachelor of Applied Science, Mechanical Engineering. Andrew is a certified professional engineer and is a certified healthcare facilities manager. Rod Foley is the President of North Mechanical Contracting and Service. With North Mechanical since 2000, Rod became part owner in 2015 and works as president, overseeing construction operations. Prior to North, Rod received his BS in Building Construction Management, specializing in mechanical construction, from Purdue University in 2000. He completed the Mechanical Contracting Association of America's Institute of Project Management course as a student in 2004 and now serves as a faculty member and instructor. He also completed the advanced course in 2007, and Advanced Leadership Institute in 2016. Rod currently serves on the MCAA National Board of Directors and is the chair of the MCAA's Project Management Education Committee and is a former member of the Technology Committee as well as the BIM Committee that developed and published Achieving Spatial Coordination Through BIM, a Guide for Specialty Contractors. Kevin Silvas is a project executive at North Mechanical Contracting and Service. A graduate of Purdue University with a Bachelor of Science in Building Construction Management, Kevin has worked for North Mechanical for nearly 13 years. And finally, Adam is the Director of Engineering and Principal at BSA. Adam graduated from Butler University with a Bachelor of Arts in Economics and Purdue University with a Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering. He is also a member of the BSA Board of Directors and a board member of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce and the Central Indiana Chapter of the ASHRAE Board of Governors. Welcome to the show, everyone, and thank you for joining us. I appreciate you guys being here. As we're talking about design and assist on this episode, I'd like to start by going around the room and getting a brief introduction of each of your roles on the Riley Maternity Tower project that everyone was involved in. Riley was a complex five-story renovation that this group worked on and was a design assist project. So, Andrew, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, sure. So, Andrew Gorman, Director of Facility Support Operations at Riley. The Maternity Tower project was a little interesting for me personally because I started it when I was with the GC on the project award. And then shortly after, I got the opportunity to come on board at Riley in the facilities department. So then I got to be on the owner side of things.
Adam, how about you?
It started off, it was a project that was coming from a long history of building up for that project. And so I started a little bit later. I think it was already after scoping deck or SDs. But I was a mechanical engineer on the project, taking it over at that point.
Okay. Kevin Hutton, how about yourself?
Yeah. So, you know, I'd been at BSA for about 20 years of my career. I happened to step away for about 3 or 4 years and worked for another firm and returned to BSA in 2018. And at that time, the project was well onto design. And if I recall, it was really getting to the end of design and wrapping up. So my role was really to come in. I had a long history of working with IU Health. And so when I came back to BSA as a principal, I maintained that role with IU Health as far as a principal and a client engineer. And so I really had to get up to speed on the maternity project and then continue to work on that, really is helping coordinate the design with IU Health and their expectations and just making sure that, you know, the design was a success for IU Health and MBSA as well.
Okay. And then Rod and Kevin, how about you guys?
Yeah, I'll go first because I had the easy part. So I was certainly involved early on as we were pursuing the project and getting the project kicked off. I'd been with North Mechanical at that time in excess of 20 years and had done a lot of work with IU Health, so a lot of experience there. So my role was really as an executive to make sure that we had a good strategy in place, had the right team in place, and then assure our clients and owner that they were picking the right people. So I got to make all the promises and turn to Mr. Silvis and let him actually deliver, which he did.
My role on the project was pretty much cradle to grave. So I was involved early on during the interview process and meeting with the user groups and been really just carried that on the project management side through commissioning and warranty. So still involved at Riley today. So it's pretty cool.
I'd like to find out from each of you, what made this project unique from your perspectives?
I guess for mine, it was one of the first projects where you had the opportunity to interview and really build a pre-construction opportunity for our company and to show what our value was. So having the input to, they asked us in that interview, who we thought the other MVP partner should be and building that team was fantastic to be able to be a part of that.
For me, it was, so this project was designed 2017, 2018, and it was one of the first large projects that I was really able to take on, the full mechanical scope and own that. And it was very complex, which I think we'll get into a little bit about it, yeah. But, you know, five stories of renovation and completely replacing the infrastructure within that is an awesome challenge to be a part of it. That.
Yeah. For me, it was one of the first jobs where we got to do this alternate approach that I was involved with, that I wasn't the project manager and in day-to-day operations. And so that was a bit unique for me to step back and hand over some of those reins to our staff. So it was a challenge for me personally, but a rewarding one for sure. So
yeah, tried hard not to get too far involved, right?
Get in the way. Absolutely.
Andrew, how about you?
Yeah, I think this goes back even farther than 2017 with the genesis of why we were doing it as IU Health. Some of you may know, may not know, infant mortality rate in Indiana was number three in the country for a long time. And Riley and IU Health being, the largest health organization in the state, the premier pediatric healthcare facility in the state, wanted to do something about that. A lot of different plans looked at. As Adam mentioned, we settled on a almost 600,000 square foot renovation. That was the hospital in the 80s. So when we effectively called the building phase three, it was built in the 80s, 1980s. And then that was the hospital. And then we've built on since then. And everybody on this call was part of the IPD project that built the current hospital, right? Tower. So there was fond memories of that, at least the second half of that project, that we wanted to carry into this one. And that's the one we started. Kevin Silvis mentioned some of the interviews, discussions of his team coming together in an integrated fashion. And then there was changes during design of the contract structure. So that made it challenging too for everybody on the call, including on the owner side, even though it was our decision. So I think there was a lot of uniqueness about this, a lot of opportunities to learn some best practices and primarily how not to do things. Always open to innovate and try different things, and appreciative of the partners on this discussion today to talk about what we can learn from this.
You know, I think a ton of things that I think were unique. Andrew mentioned probably the single biggest, I think, impact this project had, and that was the services and the whole purpose of the maternity tower project. Adam touched on the fact that we were renovating a tower with certain areas of that tower that needed to maintain services, the outpatient imaging, there's some sterile processing areas, some other things. The systems we were putting in, I think Riley facilities people, like their maintenance people, were not used to seeing those type of systems. So I think there was some trust there we had to build, and certainly had to develop their comfort level for what we were designing. And then finally, I mean, right when we're in the middle of construction, that's when all the COVID fund hit. And so that was a challenge with, you know, I know Kevin and Rod know as well as anybody, the staffing, and we're trying to keep things moving and support construction while there's that major hurdle to overcome. So there were a lot of challenges, I think, on the project.
Well, let's go back. Maybe you guys can talk about how did the team come together for this project and what really drove the decision to use the design assist model on this project?
Yeah. So as the team came together, a number of iterations, particularly on the BSA side of things. Adam, I think, was the third engineer that we ended up working with. We accept that we can be fickle as an owner at times, but it was very important to us that this project went successful to impact the patient population, right, to make a difference in the community. And with some of our partners internal, we had some personalities that clashed with, you know, contract labor as well as internal politics. We had some turnover, right, early on, decision-making level of turnover. So there was a lot of that was going on. And the team, I appreciate, you know, this team here, because even though some of us are working for different companies, we still were on the project and can see it through. And I think that shows community partnership, number one, and wanting to make a difference. So the people that stuck around, the people that executed the job, are the people that wanted to be there. Ultimately what it comes out of for me, and not just from a business perspective. I truly believe that the people in this discussion and the people that work on the project had a desire to be a part of that project, be a positive influence in the community. And I think that's why the project was successful. Yeah, we had a lot of hiccups, a lot of hurdles. But to me, the people that ended up being there were the people that wanted to be there.
Yeah, it's a good point. You're all representing different organizations, but you're all on the same team, of course.
I think from the decision to go design assist, like Andrew mentioned before, there was the IPD project of Simon Family Tower previously that was very successful with basically the same team members and carrying that forward, that thought forward on how can we deliver this project efficiently, this very complex project efficiently. And there are things within our industry that we do on the normal delivery, standard delivery of design, bid, build, of we coordinate everything and then we hand it off to Kevin and Rod and the mechanical contractors, and then they re-coordinate everything. And so it break it all down and make sure what we've designed can actually be built. And then they have the full, you know, responsibility of BIM coordination as well, where we kind of, with IPD and this design assist team, we're bringing them all together. We knew it was going to be very, very complex, lots of hiccups with these types of large renovations. And I think it was ultimately the right decision for this project type.
So Rod and Kevin, how did North Mechanical approach the design assist process?
Yeah, kind of back on what Adam was talking about. You know, we had just finished up the Simon Tower project and kind of rolled into this one. So treated it a lot of the same way. I just remember our main detailer that we had was so involved with BSA's design team and trying to draw this job with their design intent and coordinate as we go. So that was it helped to just draw this job once.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the other approach that was key for us was selecting the team that we went with this project. Obviously, Kevin from a management side led for us. The foreman that was on the project was a foreman that was a part of the tower IPD project that was mentioned previously. So that continuity of people that understood the building, understood healthcare work, had been in alternate style contracts before was the key for us. So they understood the nuances and the differences of taking a traditional design, bid, build project. And kind of to some extent, you have to throw that mindset away from our perspective and reset how you look at things. And so having that continuity was key for us.
Absolutely. And then Kevin Hunton and Adam, how does this differ from his role compared to traditional delivery methods?
Well, from a design engineer standpoint, Kevin had mentioned taking our design parameters and then fully building that out. So when we're talking about distribution ductwork and piping and, you know, where exactly the terminal boxes are laid out, like, yes, we assigned CFMs and zones and maybe did this is how we want a patient room to look like. And then we worked with North, and it's basically I laid out the mains, and then they did all of the rest of the BIM coordination and laying out and using that to set up shop drawings right away and having that that BIM coordination process alongside of design is different than the design bid build, because we would do all of that distribution. We'd have somebody draw out and rep and have all of that coordination done ourselves, but then hand it off and they have to take it all and do it again. So it's different that way, because the documents still looked like a normal deliverable, but how we worked and who did what, we had an entire responsibility matrix. And there were some lessons learned on that as well. Like, we could have better defined a couple of things, but that's to be expected as we work through projects like this. It's more, what are our parameters and what are our design intent? They took that and ran with it.
Adam hit it. All the wasted time and the rework of effort that was able to be eliminated there. Adam's not drawing it all, and then Kevin Silvis's team's not coming in and just redrawing it all. And so that's not just a waste of effort, but it's a waste of time. You're kind of churning the meter there just to repeat work. But the other thing is great, because when Kevin's group is drawing it, they're also looking at the coordination. They're looking at site survey stuff. So knowing that when they're drawing it, it's going to go in that way as much as you can with an existing building, of course. But it's one thing for us as engineers to sit at our desk and kind of draw it, and then they get it and realize that it's not going to be able to be fabricated that way. It's just the benefit really is for that installer to be doing that final coordination, really that design piece, because there is some design responsibilities there in sizing some of those ducts and mains. And then the other piece I think that was really a benefit, and we touched on it, was just the ability for the relationship, I think, between the design firm, the owner, and the contractor, and just the ability to pick up the phone and ask a question. We can document it later via RFI or clarification, but just that speed of response, picking up the phone and asking the question was, I think, helped a lot with the overall schedule of the project.
What are some of the specific examples where Design Assist created value on this project?
So the air handling units of the basement is the first thing that comes to mind. And there, when I say complexities of designing this project and some of the infrastructure needing to remain in order to serve stuff on this building, like the first floor radiology, all had to remain operational. And so we had to backfeed all of the electrical, plumbing, and the air handling that served this space as we went down one air handling unit, went down another air handling unit, and built it in place and started. I mean, it was a big puzzle game. And so there is that complexity on top of we had telecom lines, we had large high voltage lines, and we had this 3-inch oxygen main that ran through the basement right over the top of all of these air handling units that we needed to replace. And if we wanted to touch that oxygen line, it would take semi trucks of oxygen tanks in order, because it came from a different university hospital campus, came over here and served the entire campus of oxygen for Riley. And so it was a huge deal. So when we first started laying out the new air handling units and stuff, having the contractors there that are like highlighting these things that are going to be really expensive to move, like all of the logistical complexities that come with it, and then having it input into the design was massive. I know we did the air handling units in the basement was like probably the highest coordination of air handling units I've ever done, like two like half an inch. And I know building them couldn't have been that much fun, Kevin.
I almost forgot about the air handling
until he reminded you.
Yeah. I mean, it is a great point, because I can remember one of the first trips down to that basement talking about those air handlers, mm-hmm. and we were already sketching out and figuring out how in the world are we going to get all this stuff down. I mean, just access to it alone was a huge issue, and so being that far out in front of it when the air handlers are still being designed, that we're planning how are these things actually going to get installed. That's huge. That time that you pick up, and Kevin, you mentioned schedule, it allows so many of these things that have a finish to start relationship to start melding together and overlapping. And that's where you start seeing some of the efficiencies in the schedule. It allows for so much more planning up front from our perspective.
I can't remember if you said that, Adam, but like the 3D scanning in the basement was huge. And I know we used that really throughout construction to try to help locate some of those things and plan around them even as there were changes that came. It allowed us to at least be able to plan around and reroute services and miss those things in the field.
Yeah. You had the foreman, right? Because I can remember the electrical contractor was on site with their foreman, our foreman's on. So they're planning. You have the people that are actually going to do the work as a part of that, as opposed to at the end or when they're getting ready to do all this work, they're starting that planning. So that was huge.
And I think that right there, that collaboration, understanding the design early on before the drawings even come out, as you're developing the budget, it forced us to have a lot more conversations and it really, the contract allowed us to be with the electricians and make sure that they picked up certain scope, or that we coordinated with the ductwork contractor on when this plumb wall could be built. And that area there in that basement would be very tough to put all of that information and phase it out and sequence it on a set of drawings. And Adam did a dang good job on that. But did he pick up all of it? No. But at the end of the day, we knew what was expected in design, so we didn't have those disagreements. The other value add there was, as we developed the logistics plan in the atrium, we designed a lift in the atrium that we were able to use so that we could utilize prefabrication and build racks and assemblies so we weren't stick building. When you look at that job initially, there's no way that anyone would have bid that job to optimize electric productivity in the form of fabrication. So it allowed us to cut money out of that budget right up front and trust that the team was going to stick with that plan.
Yeah. How did the early contractor involvement influence the design and construction process? You were starting to touch on a little bit of the coordination that happened earlier.
The coordination of where cranes were going to be when we were building how you phase the project and what we needed to set units. There were units that were set up on the fifth floor, because it's a sixth floor penthouse. And at that time they were working on the entrance. So coordinating all of that work and making sure that it was coordinated up front. So we scheduled our air handler deliveries to allow for the front entry to be finished or not started yet. And everyone just knew what was expected early on. So there weren't those last minute surprises.
What were some of the biggest challenges that this team overcame together?
And I think the manpower was definitely an issue that was exacerbated during COVID. I saw quality suffer a bit from contractors that I'm not used to seeing subpar quality from. And what I'm not calling North out, it's across the board. Like, you notice that these are not people that typically have this issue and we're struggling with this issue. So there was definitely a team effort there of understanding, one, how are we going to get the job done? Right, we all have this manpower constraint, but we still have a deadline, right? We have promises to our community to get this job completed on time. So we definitely came together there for sure. There was a lot of constructability challenges, as Kevin mentioned, with this job, that I do think that impact-wise, from a financial perspective, we would have ended up, the job would have ended up being more expensive than it would have otherwise without the integration. It's hard a lot of times to justify when you get to the end of a job and you say this approach versus this approach, you know, which one's better, particularly on renovations. Just transparently, when you look at $1 per square foot, this job doesn't stick out as a big money saver, right? It's kind of right in where we think it to be, if even a little bit higher than where we typically see renovation projects, at least within the IU Health portfolio. So it doesn't stand out as, obviously this is the way to do it from a financial perspective, right? But it does, what's not in that story is all the challenges we encountered, all of the existing facility that had to be maintained, existing operations that Epic maintained. There was a significant amount of change orders to this job that raised the cost to the owner at the end that I think would have been multitudes more had we not had a collective, a design assist team. I think a lot of the stuff Kevin mentioned of like just being comfortable to pick up the phone and call, that saves a lot of time, and time is money because none of us are volunteering. So I think that all needs to be considered and part of the story.
One of the things that, like an example of that, the complexities of this building is, well, one, this building, it's hard to even put into words how like complex it is from levels going up. I mean, we have shafts that jog. We have a bunch of different, I call them dog houses, but they're small penthouses all over the roofs. I think we went from like 100 exhaust fans in the renovation down to 8 large general exhaust fans. So the complexities that come with all of that. And then you add in, we went 5-4-3-2 and basement. It was kind of throughout the whole thing because that's where most of the infrastructure is. But the fifth floor, we ripped out the ceilings and found that even though we designed the building in 1983, had all of the structural drawings, there were some beams that weren't even in the spot that they were supposed to be in when they were constructed in 1983. And so that you find that, and the coordination of the structure is like number one with big ductwork. And so then you have to react and change to it and adapt the design, which was able to be done through this BIM coordination process. And we, on every floor, then the contractor scanned the entire structure to make sure that it was accurate, because we did run into problems. We ended up, I think, placing windows that we weren't planning on at the beginning. We re-insulated the entire exterior because of the issues it had. The building needed a lot of love, I guess is the way I'll put it, to work through all of it, to have all of those things come up in a normal design bit built, I think would have been an absolute nightmare. I think this is one of the only ways this project was as successful as it was the team and how it was coordinated.
One thing that jumps out to me, and there's probably a lot of them, and we've talked about schedule, but there was a lot of pressure on the schedule to open up and all the planning that went into moving, I don't know how many patients, but a large number of patients into this new facility. And we were probably a week or two away from that move, and we were having problems getting airflow to the C-sections. And we found that more investigation. And of course, North and their group was helping us with some investigation. We saw there was just a top of a shaft. The duct fitting in there was, I guess, not optimal. So we were taking a larger pressure drop than we expected. And so we didn't have to write a change order. We didn't have to write a PR. It was like, here's what we need to do. Let's hand sketch it up. They went in 2 weeks before opening and were taking out a shaft, taking out a duct, reworking all this just to make it work. And we were able to get the airflow and get everything working okay. But it was certainly a little cutting it close. And
a little bit, right?
At that point, if we were going through the process of change orders and quotes back and everything, it would have been a big problem. We wouldn't have been able to move on time. So
I don't think I ever mentioned that. I think we had like 14 foot floor to floor or 14-6 or something like that. That, which for any architects or engineers listening, that's not a lot of space, especially when you're talking about trying to fit in ORs for the C-section rooms and all of the systems that serve everything.
You've touched on a little bit how the design assist process impacted some of the schedule management, cost controls, and the quality that you've talked about, Andrew. The only thing that we haven't touched on that I want to was the facility operations planning.
Yeah, I think the owner was also able to be part of this process, right? So then maybe like a design to build, it's kind of this and things. Sometimes the owners will tell on us on the sidewalks that we're invited to, right? Because other things come up. But the collaborative approach to this gave us motivation to do that. We dedicated time to that. And we went back and forth with North on a couple of things, piping-wise, VAV piping, packs and different things. That was able to be more collaborative than it would have been otherwise. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's important that you look at the whole picture of what design assist is and what it means for the mindset of the team, right? Because it's with the mindset of collaboration, much like IPD is, and why I think it's the way to go, is you're setting the example, you're setting the expectation that this is going to be a team effort. With the design, build, build kind of process, you're setting the expectation that it's going to track, right? I'm paying you for this service, you're going to give me this service, anything above this service, you're going to pay me for, number one, but also we're going to take effort, you're going to put effort on your side to make sure that it's easy for me to do that and vice versa. I think as people, right, I mentioned earlier that the people that worked on this job are the people that wanted to be there. So I think there's an element of that to collaboration. But ultimately, when you set up the structure of the team and the contract in a collaborative manner, you're more likely to get collaborative results.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point, Andrew. That's been our experience with these alternate contractual methods. There's an extreme ownership that gets put on every person that's on that team or every member of that team. So to your point, it in a design bid build, we have a set of drawings. We're going to put in exactly what that set of drawings says. And obviously, if we see an issue, we're going to bring it up. But our job is just to put in what has been shown. And being involved in the design and in this fashion, I own this design as much as BSA does. So I can't sit, we're halfway through construction and go, what'd you do that for? You should have known that wasn't going to work. I was right there the whole time. And so I own it. And so it's in my vested interest to make sure that this works and we make this work. And so we're going to do what we have to do to make it work. And it's just a shift in mindset. And it shifts from risk mitigation and self-preservation to let's make the decisions that are right for this project. And I think if you talk to anybody outside of construction that hasn't lived in this world, would just assume that's how buildings are built. We've all been around long enough to know that's not how it gets built. I mean, a lot of times we go into self-preservation mode and the end result is not at the forefront of every decision that's made. And so I think to me, that's one of the monumental shifts is just that shift in mindset.
Rod, you just touched on something I was going to ask about, which is from your perspective, how's project delivery evolved through the years?
Well, the two bald guys should probably talk about this because we got the most experience, right? I mean, when I first started, you heard a little bit about design build and we did a little bit of that. I'd never heard of design assist. I surely had never heard of IPD. And we've been fortunate enough to see all of those and be a part of all of those. And we're seeing more of it. It's funny. It kind of ebbs and tides. You know, the last couple of years, the market around here, we haven't seen a whole lot of those opportunities as like we were seeing previously, but we're seeing it pick up again. But I get to be involved nationally through the Mechanical Contractors Association. And so I get to see what a lot of contractors are doing elsewhere. And you go out to the West Coast and you see a ton of this. I mean, it's more prevalent probably than traditional methods. And so I just think you're going to continue to see this trend of more and more early involvement with the critical trades.
I think the first time I worked on a design assist project, it was probably around the 2007, 2008. In a lot of ways, it was a successful project and it was similar to the maternity tower in the sense that it was occupied and it was a maintained service to some parts of the building while you're renovating others. And it definitely showed a lot of benefits in some ways. I think as a young engineer, you get spoiled a little bit because you do have a whole level of expertise on your team that you wouldn't have had otherwise. And so that feedback is immediate. You're not just designing something thinking it's going to work and in your mind it works. You can actually go to the installer and make sure they're in agreement and they can make it work. And so as far as that goes, I think I've had some exposure and there's certainly a lot of benefits. I've also worked on them where it's just so much of it comes down to the team because I've worked on them where it's been like, we could have just bid this job. I mean, we kind of missed the mark on the intent. I think the design assist kind of contract helps make it easier to break down some of those walls and create a high performing team, but it doesn't guarantee it. A lot of it still comes down to the individuals and just the willingness to work together and share that common purpose.
So you, Rod, you touched on this too just now, but where do you guys see project delivery heading in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think specifically in this market, in central Indiana, because of the craziness that's going on and the demand on the construction industry, that I think owners are wanting to see more of this because they're wanting to secure and make sure that they can even get the contractors on their jobs and the people that they're going to need. So I think from that standpoint, you're definitely going to continue to see it grow. I also just think it's a better delivery method. And I think we're getting enough data now to say, enough experience to say, this, generally speaking, works out better for the end user and everybody involved. So I truly believe this is not something that's going to die off anytime soon.
Andrew, would you agree with that?
I do agree that I think it's the future, the right way to go. I do think we're fighting, particularly in healthcare, number one, turnover at decision maker levels, and also getting people into decision making levels that don't have a background in construction, right? Because it's a little bit scary when it's presented to you as this collaborative approach that we're going to trust Rod and Kevin and Adam to deliver this space for us. From someone with a healthcare background, a clinical background, if you will, that's, I don't want some type fitter designing my hospital. That's crazy. They don't know what I need, right? They've ever done a heart transplant. So you immediately start having that challenge of trust, right? And it's going to take us as an industry, particularly in the Midwest, to drive it collaboratively. It can't be one designer or one prime sub on a job that says, we should be doing it this way, guys. It's going to get steamrolled. I'm sure everybody has gotten that situation before. Because from the owner side of things, it feels contractually safer to design than build, right? It's very much of looking out for yourself, right? Particularly when you don't have a background in it, it's scary. And even if you do, like I've been in construction for over a decade now, and there is still some nuances of alternate delivery methods that I don't fully understand or appreciate. If it was to come down to a courtroom situation, what does that mean? Where are the lines? So that's where it gets a little bit like, am I really getting any benefit for this? Everybody goes back to financials. I mentioned that earlier. There hasn't been a ton of data that shows that this is financially beneficial to go this route. It's more of you're getting a better product, right? You asked about facilities management earlier, and I think that's where the payback is, but those dollars are very hard to find, right? Because you get a standard budget every year to maintain your building, and some smart person gets put in charge of that budget to maintain that building, and they either do or they don't. And there's not a lot of oversight, and there's not a lot of integration in the construction, right, at handoff, where I think that these delivery methods open up avenues for more integration with management. We talked about 3D scanning areas. There's a lot of push on the facility side of things to start using 3D scans, 3D models for building management, talk about digital twins and those different buzz terms. AI and facilities management is something that's very exciting. But if the old crusty mechanics that take care of our buildings that I love to death don't tell the AI machine what to do, it doesn't know what to do.
Right.
So we got to get that information into these machines and let them be tools for us. Where right now, it's going to take a while, particularly in the Midwest. I agree with Rod that you see it more on the coasts. You see the innovation more on the East than the West Coast. Somewhat in Texas. Texas is a big hotbed right now for innovation from a construction perspective. So it's exciting. The future's exciting. I think we have a ways to go in the Midwest, though.
So what advice would you guys give to others that may be considering design assist or other more integrated project delivery methods from what you've learned from this project?
I really think, and this comes from being involved in a number of these varying levels of success, one of the biggest things that I've seen that led to a feeling of a lack of success on a project is a clear understanding of what is design assist on this particular project. So we've done design assist that in essence was really just constructability review. We had very little involvement in design. We just take a set of prints, smell check the budget, and is this constructible? So we've done from that to IPD, where we're actually doing the permit set drawings and coordinating along the way. So that level of involvement can be a huge range of expectations. And so just having that clear definition of here's what the owner expects, here's what the designers expects, here's what the contractor expects, and everybody be on the same page. Because I've seen it where it's not, and it ends in disappointment usually for everybody.
So we touched on it multiple times, I think, but the team members that are chosen, the experience of both the design firm, the contractors, the tolerance for the client side of it, of to try to take on a different contract form, all of it needs to be right for it to be successful. There's a lot of trust built there. Like we said before, the team that you're looking at had delivered multiple projects together. And my recommendation is to truly vet those teams, understand how they would work with each other, how they understand what Design Assist means to them, like Rod just said.
And actively work on that team. So you know, on this project, we had a retreat early on, and everyone got in the same room for multiple days. And there was team building exercises in there, and there was planning and scheduling and all those things. But at the end of the day, when you walked out of there, you had an agreement, you had a bond, and there was trust that was established with the team, and that helped throughout.
You know, I'd say the one thing we haven't talked a lot about, and I feel like as an owner, we get a free pass a lot of times. So we talk about the designer, we talk about the construction, but the other kind of leg to that stool, if you will, is the owner. So I think in order to have a successful project, first and foremost, is you need, as the owner, and we're always improving, but defining that scope early on, trying to answer questions before they're even asked. So having a strong project requirement document or something to at least pass that message on to the designers and the contractors, just to know what makes a successful project for an owner. We're always asking these guys to go faster and go faster, but if they have to come back to us and ask questions, and then we have to take it back to a group of stakeholders, I mean, that's churn as well. So anything we can do as an owner to help feed them information before they even ask for it, preferably, certainly helps that whole process go a lot smoother.
Anything that you would all do differently on your next Design Assist project? Biggest lessons learned, if you will.
Not change our mind 3 or 4 times before we even get going on delivered model.
But also, we talk a lot about trust, and I think the catalyst here is that level of trust amongst all the players. But trust is built over time, and it can go away faster than it's built, for sure. And often that over time is longer than a project timeline, right? So it's the level of trust that, to me, I'm speaking for me specifically, the level of trust we're talking about is not something that's achieved over the course of a project, right? This is projects building on top of other projects. And I think as an industry, to really get to where we need to be from a high-performance team perspective, it takes those nuanced conversations on smaller projects in between the big ones, that collaboration, that grace that's given, both on the owner side, we ask for grace of, you guys know what you're doing better than we do. We like to stand up and tell you that we know what we're doing and you're going to do this for us and we know best, but oftentimes we don't. So give us that grace and understanding that help us see what we don't see, help us see the problems we don't see. And then the grace that we ask of you is understand that it's hard to sell an alternate method when there isn't hard data. And it's hard to tell a leader that we need to do it this way because Rod's a good dude, because Kevin's a good dude, right? I really like working with them. We need to do it this way. That doesn't necessarily get decisions made.
Right.
When you can show a history of success on projects and cooperation, and then also being able, I think the real interesting piece here is being able to have that collaboration, but also have it open to competition, right? That's where it gets really challenging, because when the government money is in funding these projects, there's an element of competition that has to be present. And that goes against like building historical relationships. You have to build it with 3 or 4 different industry firms that do the same thing. And that takes a lot of time and effort. So I think there's definitely challenges, but I'd say keep the conversation going and give grace, because without grace, you'll never get trust.
It's really good insight.
I think one of our experiences has been you get in this highly collaborative environment and everybody's excited, things are going well, you've got a schedule, you've got a plan, you've got a design, and this somewhat small group of or the small team has built all this. And then you start bringing in all the workforce, you bring in the troops. It takes an army to build these things. Well, all those folks that come onto the job site don't have all that history and knowledge that we all have as being in the fight from day one. And so some education that we're in a different contractual setup for this project, and the way that you've done 90% of your career, Mr. Pipefitter, yeah, we're going to throw that out and we're going to change the game. Don't be surprised if Steve Bales, the plumbing engineer, comes up and grabs you and walks the floor and says, hey, I don't like this. And what are we doing here? That those are all different things that they're not used to. And so just making sure that message gets sent out to everybody that ends up on that job site. It's very easy. This is not the perfect solution. Problems are going to arise. Fights are going to happen. It's very easy to fall back in that traditional mindset of self-preservation. And I think that just making sure everybody understands that this is different is a key to success as well.
And then just early engagement with the foreman and superintendent, like Ron was saying. I mean, we brought our foreman on and superintendent on earlier than most projects in the past, but it could have been just a little bit earlier. Just as soon as you can get that wealth of information from that field support is huge.
Yeah. So are there some things on this project that I do differently moving forward? I mean, I think every project's that way.
Sure.
Like, especially big, complex renovations, and find things that you can improve upon as a firm, as a person. There's a lot like design or the responsibility matrix and fleshing that out a little bit more than we had it. Maybe like Kevin said of, superintendents and my involvement with them, having them is to maybe some more time with facilities up front. I remember we had a strainer on a different side of the coil than we wanted, and we repiped all of it because it fouled and it was different than what they wanted. Just, things like that, ultimately, I think you still had a very successful project with things you learned from along the way on every single project.
Well, that ties into my last question for everybody before we wrap up, which is what makes you most proud of the Maternity Tower project?
I think just the success of the project is super apparent that where this team has still done a lot of work. So it's the project started 10 years ago and I'm still having regular conversations with people that were on that team still today. And then my other is just the sense of accomplishment or the support that we're providing to the community. So when this project was taking off, my wife and I, we had our first daughter and she was born and she had pulmonary heart stenosis. And, as a 6-month-old baby, she had to undergo surgery. She's a thriving, healthy 9-year-old girl now. And it's because of the work that we do in this community. So
that's awesome.
I actually have a similar tie. I mean, I had my son in 2020. And he got transferred to Riley for a few days. The care there is just outstanding. And it was just a few days of making sure everything was right. He was breathing really fast. But I needed a break from the stress of that. And it was when the construction process was going on. And I went down and went to this team for a construction meeting while my son was upstairs. But that was a relief for me to do my work again and be a part of the team that was going through it. Building downstairs as we had a kid. And then my sister, actually, after this building got built, is now a neonatologist working within the building at Riley. So there's just a lot of connections that I'm very connected to this project with and really proud of it in a lot of different ways.
That's cool.
When you're going to pull up your dancing this
weekend? Yeah. Oh, man.
Everybody show up and watch it this weekend.
We may need some video. Give us some sneak peek.
I know they did it. You did it last year. Two years ago.
Yeah, two. Yeah.
I think from my perspective, what I'm most proud of is the impact the Maternity Tower is making in the community. But from a constructability perspective, I'm proud that we proved it can happen. We took a 40-year-old primary pediatric facility that was built in the mindset of the 80s. We talked about some of those mindsets.
Mm-hmm.
We made it a modern facility. We even changed it from pediatric to adult care. And when you look at something on paper, that is not a challenge that a lot of people will run towards, but it's an actualization with the campus we're on. We are landlocked. It's an actualization with IU Health. And many healthcare facilities across the country face this: aging buildings,
is it better just to tear it down? There's been so many tear downs. There's one right down the road from us that everybody's well aware of. So to prove that we can do it, to prove it with the right team, it's possible. I'm very proud of, and something that I lean on multiple times as I try to sell future projects to my leadership team of, you know, if you allow us to choose the right team, we can accomplish these things and continue to use the building we have. We don't have to tear down and start over.
That's good. I've worked at Riley for a long time, and I think just being able to support their mission, that's very fulfilling, and knowing that you're doing your job and you're helping them do their job better, which in turn benefits the community and individuals, like you've heard from Kevin Silvis and Adam, you know, just anecdotally the impact it has to people who've worked on the project, not to mention just countless others that depend on Riley. So
absolutely,
you know, it's definitely a higher purpose. You feel like you're really contributing.
I would echo all those sentiments. I mean, you walk into that place and it doesn't take you long to figure out what we're really doing. That's powerful. I'll never forget, it was the tower project, but I got the opportunity to sit in a user meeting where I'm listening to the nurses that are on the burn unit and some of the stories. And I mean, it just, you couldn't help but get choked up just sitting there listening to some of those stories and what they're doing. And you hear that, it resets, like, you know, we fight and we argue and we battle and we're out there protecting our companies and doing the best we can. But at the end of the day, none of that really matters. Yeah. It's about what we're trying to do in this building. And to be able to say that we took part in that is pretty powerful.
Well, not a better way to wrap up than the impact that it's had on the community. So thank you all for joining me today. This has been fantastic.
Thanks for having us.
I'd like to thank Andrew, Kevin Hutton, Rod, Kevin, Silvis, and Adam again for joining me on this episode of BSA by Design. You can connect with them on LinkedIn. If you're interested in learning more about BSA, we encourage you to visit our website at bsalifestructures.com. There's a link in the show notes to contact us for more information, as well as a link to the Riley project we discussed today. Be sure to subscribe to BSA by Design on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music so you don't miss an episode. And we've got more content and project stories to share on social media, so be sure to follow us on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and X. That's going to do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.